In 2009, the global community faced another deadly pandemic, a novel strain of influenza known as H1N1 or the swine flu. According to a 2012 CDC report, between roughly 151,000 and 575,000 people worldwide likely died from that disease in the first year it circulated. About 12,000 people died in the U.S. that year, plus or minus. While the COVID-19 outbreak is on track to be far more deadly than the swine flu, there have been some distinct differences in how communication about the outbreaks has been handled by the media and by government agencies. Our next guest joins us now to talk about how the media covers pandemics, what we can learn from 2009, and how what we all can take away or what we can all take away from the COVID-19 outbreak. Glenn Nowak is the director of the Grady College Center for Health and Risk Communication and professor of advertising at the University of Georgia. He worked for the CDC during the H1N1 outbreak. Glenn, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting me.
And Glenn, take us back to 2009. You were working at the CDC. What were the first thoughts about how to communicate about the risk of this new version of the flu?
Well, in 2009, I was director of media relations for CDC, and one of my press officers came to me, and he was assigned to working with the flu experts, and he said, they have discovered a new flu virus, and the discovery was made with a couple of samples from some children in California who had non-remarkable flu. Their flu looked exactly like typical seasonal flu. And he said, the scientists are planning on writing this up and releasing it in one of the CDC publications in a couple of weeks. And I just think that we might want to speed that timeline up. We might want to, you know, let people know that we've discovered this virus, because who knows how prevalent this virus is, and who knows if it's serious, but it just seems like a good idea. And so we went and approached the acting CDC director at the time, Dr. Rich Besser, and Ann Schuchat, who is still at CDC, who is my boss, and we said, I think we need to talk about this sooner rather than later. And they agreed, and so we had those scientists speed up their timeline for letting people know, and we moved it up to a Monday or a Tuesday, and we did that. And a lot of our thinking was we wanted people to know that we had discovered a new flu virus. We weren't sure what it meant. We had some more samples coming to CDC from other people who had flu, and we were going to look at those samples to see if they were the same virus. And we contacted a lot of reporters who were health and science reporters who we thought would be interested in this news. And their initial response was kind of a little skeptical. They wanted to know how much severe illness it caused and was it more deadly. And when we told them we only had a couple of samples from some children who had kind of typical flu, their response was kind of muted, but things unfolded pretty rapidly. We soon learned after we made that public that Canada had been testing some samples, some flu virus samples that it had received from Mexico, and Mexico had been having a really bad flu season, and it turned out it was the same virus that was causing much of that flu. And so at that point, we switched into a much different, more aggressive mode in terms of being transparent and communicating with the public. And we held press conferences every day for about 8 weeks straight.
And that makes me think an interesting point in what you just said is communicating uncertainty. That's something in the early stages of a new disease, whether it's a new version of the flu or this novel coronavirus that really is behaving in ways that we're not sure what's going on in the early days. That idea of talking about it, but letting us know what we don't know. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So the first press conference that Dr. Besser did, one of the things that he did, which was unique at the time, was he talked about uncertainty and how it would affect both CDC's recommendations and CDC's actions. So one way it affect CDC's actions was that he made the point that we were going to be working to learn as fast as possible, as much as we could, about the virus and who was contracting the virus, what the illness looked like, so that we could make recommendations and advice that would help protect people. He also talked about the fact that things were going to change probably quickly and unpredictably when it came to CDC recommendations and public health actions. Because as you learn more, you're going to be able to make changes that are going to improve your public health response. And so he warned people. And we made a habit of telling journalists and the public pretty much almost every single day that was a possibility. We told people that they were going to see differences across the country and across the world in terms of what communities and states were going to do in response to the virus, because the virus was going to be playing out in different ways in different places. And so it made sense that you would see different responses. And then we also told people that it was a good thing that you were going to see different things tried, because that was going to help us learn as much as possible. If everybody was doing the same thing, you wouldn't learn as much. And so having different approaches being taken in different places when the virus is at different stages actually helps in terms of finding what might be most effective.
Talking to Glenn Nowak now at the University of Georgia, used to do public health communications for the CDC, talking about two pandemics, the 2009 outbreak of H1N1 flu, and now this one today, the COVID-19, and how public agencies and the media communicate about these things. Glenn, have you seen that kind of transparency about uncertainty and change in our response this time around?
Well, it's been hard to see that. There's been uncertainty, certainly, perhaps not so much intentionally, though. A lot of the uncertainty has been caused by conflicting messages. And I think it's unclear to many people what is the end goal. We knew in 2009 that we had some pretty clear end goals in mind. We knew that one of our primary goals, obviously, was to do as much as we possibly could to reduce and prevent the spread of that virus and to minimize the amount of people who were going to suffer severe harm. Another goal, though, that we actually had was that we were cognizant that we had to be mindful of social and economic disruption. And so another goal was to minimize, to the extent that we could, social and economic disruption. I think today it's unclear as to how those two things are integrated or how they're being brought together. And as a result, they seem like they're at odds. And I think that's what's causing a lot of the uncertainty about, you know, what should we be doing? What is the best path forward? And I think that uncertainty and confusion are probably not very helpful.
The other big thing that I think about as we decide when something new like this comes along and we as a team make these decisions, the government has to think about this, the media has to think about this, the balance between, okay, are we going overboard and scaring people needlessly versus are we underplaying this and not communicating the seriousness of an outbreak? How do you weigh that balancing act?
It's absolutely a balancing act, and I think it has to be something that's evaluated every day or on a regular basis as more information comes in, because depending on what the situation is, you may need more people or very, very high compliance with public health measures. If the virus is less present, not present, people need to be ready to implement and adopt those measures. One of the challenges here is that we have so much uncertainty about this virus. One of the advantages, I guess, if we had an advantage in 2009, was it was an influenza virus. And it was a virus that was pretty similar to the viruses that cause seasonal flu. And so we knew that we would be able to have a vaccine. The question then was, how fast would we have a vaccine? This virus, we're learning more every single day. And I think that makes it really hard for news media, public health agencies, in terms of their messaging about, you know, how concerned should people be. There is some research and risk communications that does indicate that, unfortunately, many people won't take action unless they do have a high level of concern, unless they do have a high level of fear, that if they only are kind of interested, that often doesn't result in people taking the kinds of actions they need to protect themselves and others.
So we continue our conversation about how the media has handled its ongoing coverage of the COVID-19 outbreak and taking a step back and comparing it to the H1N1 pandemic in 2009. Glenn Nowak is with us, director of the Grady College Center for Health and Risk Communication at the University of Georgia. He's a professor there, and he worked in communications for the CDC during the H1N1 or swine flu outbreak about a decade ago. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. How do you think the media is handling the outbreak so far? What do you want to see more or less of? Call 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Ben is with us in Madison. Ben, hello.
Hello. So I'm curious. We know that the communication, not necessarily referring directly to the media, but the communication around this issue has been terrible, and that's because we have a leader who doesn't know how to do that effectively. But I'm wondering if you could relate that to successful public health campaigns in this country, like anti-smoking, for example.
Interesting. Any thoughts there, Glenn, comparing this to public health campaigns for non-pandemic related issues?
Well, one of the things with non-pandemic or non-infectious disease related issues, one of your biggest challenges is getting people who are doing the behavior you want to change to be interested in your messages. And so you often have a bigger challenge getting attention. In an infectious disease outbreak like this one or in 2009, that problem sort of goes away. There's a lot of interest in what you have to say, and there's a lot of interest in how can I protect myself. So one of the challenges with kind of everyday health campaigns is that your biggest hurdle is getting people's attention, holding people's attention, and then providing them with enough a strong enough case to get them to want to do the behavior, such as quit smoking. In an infectious disease outbreak like this, the virus, unfortunately, is making that case for you, and so you do have people's attention, and so your efforts are now trying to guide them and get them to do things that will be most effective in terms of protecting themselves or their family.
Ben, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Dennis in Milwaukee now. Dennis, hello.
Hello.
What do you want to bring up, Dennis?
My question for Dr. Nowak is, with a secondary wave of this virus most likely hit in late fall, how are agencies like the NIH and the CDC going to potentially handle maybe another shutdown when you have people who are going to be trick-or-treating, going to Macy's Day parades, going to Christmas shopping, and end-of-year events like New Year's Eve parties like in New York City's Times Square? How are they going to potentially handle maybe another shutdown?
Interesting, Dennis. Glenn, what do you think?
Well, one of the things that public health agencies in the White House, if I was talking to them and recommending what they should do, is it's what we did in 2009, is that we spent the summer planning for that. We spent the summer spending a lot of time talking about what are the possibilities and doing a couple things. One is what would our messages be? And also, what would our messages be to warn people about those things? And so I think during the summer, I would expect that we're going to see a lot of different agencies, whether it's universities, school districts, government agencies like CDC, putting out a lot of messages, letting people know that, you know, you need to be prepared for the possibility that we may be having to do the kind of physical distancing or social distancing that we have experienced for the last few weeks again.
Thanks a lot for that call. Maybe a unique thing here, Glenn, I think is the incredible partisan divide right now, where you have at least some percentage of the population where if President Trump makes a statement about COVID-19, there's a proportion of people who will base their scientific analysis on their agreement with the president in general or their opposition to the president in general. Does that make it hard to reach everybody with the same message?
Absolutely. It's hard to reach everybody for a couple reasons. One is that there's a lot of data, including recent data from the Poynter Institute, that shows you that people tend to just get their information from a handful of media sources, and they're very loyal to those media sources. And so some people watch Fox, some people watch MSNBC, some people watch CNN, and there's not a lot of crossover. And so that one challenge is getting your messages equally presented and equal time in all three of those media channels, and that's probably not going to happen. And then when you do get your messages through to people who are at different parts of the political spectrum, they are likely to counter-argue or likely to ignore and say that, you know, I just don't believe that. I don't trust you. You're not one of the sources I trust. So it absolutely is a far greater challenge than it was in 2009 and 2010.
Briefly, is there a way to break through that?
Well, I think there's a couple things people have been trying. One is to encourage people to use a broader array of media sources, and I don't know that's a quick and easy solution. I think another approach that people have tried is to get people to understand that they don't have as much knowledge as they believe that they do about things like health and science and medical recommendations, and so you try to use the opportunities that you do get, if you're Dr. Fauci and you go on Fox shows, to try to use what, you know, the value system of the audience that you're talking to and show them how your recommendations are actually or can fit with their priorities, that they're not necessarily at odds with their priorities.
And we'll leave it there for now and watch this develop. Glenn, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
That's Glenn Nowak, director of the Grady College Center for Health and Risk Communication and a professor of advertising at the University of Georgia. He joined us today to talk about how the media covered the H1N1 or swine flu pandemic in 2009 and how the media and public health agencies are communicating about the COVID-19 outbreak today, and how journalists can tackle public health issues like this in the future. You can read an in-depth article about this at WPR.org.